did you become a historian?
How did I become an historian? I guess I really did get switched on to history from, I don't know, late school, early university times. It's the discipline for me because even though it's ostensibly about the past, it actually, for me, is the best way of thinking about and talking about the present and the future. Mm. I feel that exploring the past and understanding the moral choices that people made in the past gives a sense, actually, that nothing in the past was inevitable. So therefore, it kind of really underscores the fact that nothing in the present has to be the way it is. If you want to change something, history tells us that, you know, that times are changeable. So, so interestingly, even though, you know, people associate history with the past, for me, I love it because it's the best way in to thinking about the present and to thinking about how to change the future.
Mm, the past seems to be the most amazing looking glass into the future.
That's right, yes.
In a lot of ways.
Even though that seems paradoxical, that's how it works.
Tell us about this new book that you've got coming out, The Warrior, The Voyager and The Artist. What's it about?
Yeah, so that's the title and it is about three different people, but they all lived in the 18th century. So I guess, you know, from the outset it might look like this is a book just about the past that had nothing to do with the present or the future. But I was really interested in these three characters because they did really speak to some contemporary themes that I'm interested in. So the warrior was a Cherokee person from the 18th century. He lived through actually most of the 18th century from original Cherokee country, which was in around the Carolinas in North America. The voyager is a man called Mai, who was a Pacific Islander who also lived a kind of parallel life to Ostenaco, and he travelled with Captain Cook's second and third voyages.
Oh, wow.
Through the Pacific, so he actually visited Britain. And the third life, the artist, is Joshua Reynolds, who might be better known to some listeners, a kind of canonical, famous 18th century British artist. How he relates to these people, though, is that through his lifetime, he painted portraits of them, and he met both of them and he painted portraits of them. So originally, I'd been intrigued by the fact that Reynolds, who's sort of most famous for painting big, lavish pictures of aristocratic women, had this obviously kind of strong interest in non-British people and particularly Indigenous people of his own expanding British Empire. So I was first of all tunneled into that, and then I realised I actually had enough information to talk about all three parallel lives because they kind of live around the same time. So that's how the book started, of thinking about going from, you know, an intrigue about Reynolds into an intrigue about all three lives. And then when I got really into constructing those three lives or reconstructing those three lives, I guess the two things that were most important to me was that the two Indigenous lives really showed to me much more of an active, agentic, kind of determined confrontation with empire than I think that we often think in hindsight. I think there is an unfortunate view that when we think about the relationship between empire and Indigenous people, we always think that the Indigenous people lose, that they've always been defeated by empire, that it's a sad and tragic story.
Mm.
But tunneling down into these two Indigenous people really kind of made history bubble with how much they were in fact affecting empire and how much they were masters of their own destiny despite the huge forces of empire against them. And then the second thing I learned, I guess, from Reynolds, who's kind of stands in for empire in the book, is that he was much more conflicted about the morality of the empire around him.
Wow.
So for me, that's interesting because it also reminds us that, you know, it wasn't that British imperialists themselves weren't kind of simply bringing forth this kind of juggernaut of empire, that they themselves were worried about some of the issues, which eventually, of course, are the issues that will fracture the empire in the future. And it just reminds us again that empire, just like any other big historical phenomenon, is not inevitable. It is breakable. Things do end. So it kind of reminds us that resistance is possible, change is possible.
Yeah, wow. Was there anything in your research for this book and looking into these three historical figures that truly shocked you, surprised you to no end, that you thought, my God, what on earth?
I guess there were quite a few moments of violence that were pretty shocking, but then also kind of pretty remarkable instances of survival of violence, particularly, I guess, amongst the Cherokees with their confrontation with first British colonialists and then American revolutionaries who were in some ways were even more rapacious than the British colonials. There were some little small acts that just sort of go by often in history books is in one sentence, but actually when you stop and think about it, it is remarkable. For instance, Mai, the Pacific Islander, when he goes to Britain, lives there for nearly 2 years, he clearly learns enough English to get by and live by himself. I think that seems to me an extraordinary thing. The first Pacific Islander ever to go to Britain, the first Pacific Islander to go to Europe and make it back. And there he is learning an entirely new language at the same time as he's learning the fact that there's a whole other world out there.
Yeah.
And he's surrounded by people who think that he is a freak because they never expected to meet someone like that as well.
Exactly, yeah.
So in some ways, you know, all three lives are pretty remarkable.
You've mentioned a lot this connection between past and present and past and future. How do you think that this kind of early settler colonial history of Australia can inform contemporary society, can help us into the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that 18th century history in Australia used to be a bit more popular. I think it's not quite as popular these days, possibly because people just think, oh, it's a dismal story about convicts, and the really interesting thing about making the nation is it happened in the 19th century or the 20th century. But my book, even though it's not specifically about Australia, it is about the 18th century empire that came to Australia and founded the white Australia. And for me, I think it's interesting to really review that 18th century history and sort of to understand that, first of all, Indigenous people were resisting and accommodating and negotiating with empire far more than I think the history books suggest, popular history books or kids' history books might suggest. Yeah, and then secondly, also that imperialists themselves, when they come to, I mean, particularly someone like Arthur Phillip, he is a veteran of American imperialism, British presence in America. He knows full well that you have to negotiate with Indigenous people if you want to achieve anything. You can't just claim and conquer and plunder because there are legal ramifications if you do that. So to really remember that Phillip came to New South Wales thinking that it was going to be much more problematic and politically difficult than in hindsight it turned out to be, is important to us. My strong belief is that Phillip was preparing the way for a treaty to be signed.
Wow.
Just the way that he interacted with Indigenous people, particularly Bennelong, who's one of the key Indigenous people that he talked to. It seems to me that all those interactions are because he thinks that a treaty is on the horizon and he has to get the right kind of diplomats involved.
Yeah, political environment.
Yeah. The fact that, you know, later on we never do get a treaty makes us in retrospect think that, you know, these people just came over and never gave two thoughts about it. But yeah, looking at the 18th century makes us remember that it was actually a lot more complicated. And the 19th century history of Australia, which in many ways is more violent and horrible, is not inevitable outcome of 18th century. It's just one of the twists and turns of the past.
You mentioned Bennelong there, and I'd like to touch on that really quickly. We're nearly out of time, though, because you are involved in another project here at 2SCR very recently, a podcast about the life of Bennelong, which is very interesting. He was quite an important historical figure in 18th century Australia, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right, he was. Yes, I'm really excited about this podcast coming out soon. I think that's going to be like a three-parter. There's so much to say about his life. Most of it recently kind of revised, or some of it even kind of newly, you know, discovered by white historians anyway. And we are going to try and track his life from beginnings well before white people turn up. And then the way that he approaches Phillip, becomes kind of a diplomatic friend with him. I mean, I wouldn't say that they were necessarily as close as some historians have suggested, but, you know, they clearly had mutual political respect for each other, and they did turn out to be negotiators for their respective peoples. He also goes in the footsteps of Ostenaco and Mai, the people that I wrote about. He also goes to Britain with Phillip, and he stays there for about a year and a half. So he's another good example of a complicated Indigenous personality who reminds us that Indigenous people were controlling their own lives with the main stories in their histories. They're not just reacting to British intrusion.
Kate, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.